Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 96, recorded November 18th, 2010. SSDs can be anything.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is sponsored by the AARP Auto Insurance Program from the Hartford. Discover great rates, benefits, and service specifically designed for AARP members at aarp.thehartford.com/podcast. And by Carbonite Pro. With prices starting at $10 a month, all of your office PCs can be backed up safely and automatically. For a free trial and to learn more, visit CarbonitePro.com.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm Patrick Norton. Joining, as always, the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Shrout of PCPer.com. Are you there?
Hello, hello. How are you?
Good, man. Are you in Portland right now?
I'm in Portland. Can you tell us, I'm in the hotel. It's not raining behind me, but it's raining outside, and it's going to be raining for the next 7 days, and it's going to be like between 35 and 45 degrees, so it's wonderful. Wonderful to be in Portland.
But isn't it like 15 in Columbus right now and snowing?
I don't think we're getting any snow back home yet.
It's just cold.
You can't go anywhere without an umbrella here, I found out. So, unfortunately.
It's a gracious. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I found it out, unfortunately, by being out looking for a headset and then trying to walk back to the hotel. So,
and you got rained on.
a little.
So you got to carry around the umbrella like you're in England and just have that gracious feel to life. Your there briefcase, you your umbrella, your shoulder hat. I got to ask, are you up there for Intel or...
No, up here purely for recreation, UK basketball game, playing against Portland, taking a kind of a guy's trip vacation out to the Northeast and just hanging out. So that doesn't mean we can't cover tech while I'm here for a good hour. So.
Oh my goodness. I'm not pining for the Fjords, but I am pining for the SSD. I think we talked about this last week or the week before, how I pulled the solid state drive out of my notebook and put it back into my PC. Now my PC starts in like 4.5 seconds, which is pretty hot for Windows 7, but I've been laughing because every time I resume my MacBook from suspend, like a whip the lid open, I'm sitting there counting to like 12 before the login finally comes up. And it's been funny because, like, in terms of the apps, I don't do a lot of heavy computing on this notebook. It's primarily a lot of like, oh boy, here's another spreadsheet. Oh boy, here I am typing. Oh boy, I'm looking at a Flash video. So there's not a whole lot of stuff that taxes the performance of an SSD drive, but I'm actually really noticing it in brutal, painful ways on when I start the machine and when every time I close the lid and open the lid back up again.
it's one of those things. Once you have one, you take it away, and it's like all of a sudden you realize what you had before. The same thing happened to our video and audio editor. You know, his SSD died, and he went back to a standard hard drive for, you know, a couple of months. Finally, we got him a new SSD, and he's like, "How did I ever live without this?"
Yeah.
So it's definitely like that.
I mean, we've pointed out time and time again that, it doesn't matter what kind of hardware, but especially with solid-state drives, the longer you wait, the more you'll get for less money. But sure. It was interesting. Intel, we were talking about this on Techzilla this week. Intel launched a new 120-gigabyte solid-state drive, and they dropped the prices on pretty much all the X25M drives, which got me nosing around. So is the 80-gig $199? No, the 40-gigabyte is $99. The 80-gigabyte is $199. The 120-gigabyte... Right. The PC Per article points out it's kind of in the sweet spot, $249. That's $2.08 a gigabyte, which is a pretty prime deal. And then the whopping 160 gigabyte drive is a healthy $2.59 a gigabyte, which ends up being $415, which is a lot of money for that. But
yeah, I know we talked about last week that we were kind of disappointed that SSD just hadn't come down as much as maybe we had wanted them to. And I think it's just coming down so gradually that we're not noticing it. But if you go back and look at, you know, this new 120 gig drive that sells for $2.08 per gigabyte based on the MSRP, and look at when these drives first launched, you'll see we're up at $350, $370 per gig. So we're talking, you know, a good, you know, 60, 75% price drop in that time span. So while it's maybe not as sudden as some other things, it's much more gradual.
Yeah.
I mean, the prices are coming down, and hopefully they're coming down enough that you're going to want to replace that standard drive in your MacBook.
And it's actually, I mean, it's amazing how affordable it's getting, because I was looking at that as part of an article. Somebody's like, you know, should I buy an SSD drive? Should I wait? And I was looking at Newegg.com, and you go, Newegg, I'm over here, I'm clicking on SSD drives, and I think I saw over 100 drives that were under $200. Let's see, wow. Hard drives, SSD. You know how Newegg usually gives you the giant section of selectable, all the different things you can sort of like, yeah. Today it's not giving it. But like at the high end, it would be like $200 for a OCC Vertex Turbo, $139 for OCC Agility 2, 60 gigabyte. It's amazing how many drives there are between $100 and $200. Samsung. Actually, have you seen any of the Samsung drives? Are they any good?
64. The Samsung controller is definitely not our favorite. We'll put it that way. not awful, but they're not our favorite.
Okay, because I was looking at that, like $139 for a 64 gigabyte drive is not bad, not great, but OCC Vertex 2 drives, 90 gigabytes for $185. There's just a huge number of drives out for not that much money. So where, you know, a year ago you were looking at, you know, $250 with tax to pick up a 40 gigabyte drive to put your operating system in your favorite two or three applications, you're starting to get a little bit more breathing room, and there are a lot of options under $200. It's starting to look like a really attractive upgrade if you like sort of a kick in the pants for your machine, especially if you turn your machine on and off a lot.
I mean, I think it's, you know, you're right. Like with a laptop, it's one of those things that if you're closing the lid, if you're putting it, like I guess in Windows we'll say suspend versus hibernate. Suspend is where it keeps power on. Hibernate is where it copies everything from memory to the hard drive, and then when you resume it, it takes everything from the hard drive back to memory. And that whole hard drive back to memory process can take quite a long time to wake up from a hibernate with a standard, you know, 5400 or slower RPM, 2.5-inch hard drive. With an SSD, I mean, I was almost to the point of where I was like, do I really need to do sleep mode, or can I just use hibernate on this? Because it wakes up almost as fast, but it uses no power. You don't have to worry about, you know, taking your laptop out a day and a half later and seeing that the battery's almost gone.
And it's kind of amazing, actually, how much battery life you save going in hibernate mode versus suspend mode. And I just got the search setting I'm looking for, 73 drives between $100 and $200. And $200 and under, you're looking at something in the neighborhood of almost 100 drive options up on Newegg. So the prices are definitely dropping. Speaking of sort of price conscious stuff, AMD E350, you guys got to benchmark the Brazos platform. How'd that go?
It went pretty well. So we talked last week a little bit about the architecture and what this was. So this is the first AMD Fusion APU, their first combination of CPU and GPU into a single die, into a single package that they're marketing this particular product towards low-end, ultra-low-end desktops like small form factor PCs and that type of thing. Also, netbooks and low-cost notebooks. You know, the only thing they've publicly stated is sub $500 machines. They've been able to tell me, you know, look, we're trying to go for that Atom-based netbook. So you can expect to see probably, maybe not initially, when these parts come out in January, $379, $399, those types of prices of devices for what these are going to be. And just so you know, that's kind of the target here. We're not going to expect huge performance levels. What we compared it to in this article at PC Perspective is two different Intel platforms. One of them was an Intel Atom dual core hyper-threaded system. So it was an Atom D510, if you want to know the model numbers. It was dual core hyper-threaded. So it's got four threads of processing. And with that system, we used the integrated graphics on the Atom architecture. The other system, we went kind of with the upper end of what Intel's offering in these types of solutions. And it was an Intel Celeron CULV part, which is actually like a Core 2 type architecture part running at 1.2 gigahertz, so a pretty low frequency, but dual core plus the NVIDIA Ion chipset. The NVIDIA Ion chipset's kind of like what we all assume makes a netbook or a small form factor PC like this you know, worth a damn, essentially, right? We all kind of assume, yeah, graphics power on the Atom is not going to be good. If you want to do anything, you'll need NVIDIA IO. So we kind of wanted to compare it against these two things. And in general, what we found was the new Bobcat architecture on the Zacate Brazos platform, whatever you want to call it, the E350, runs at 1.6 gigahertz. The CPU performance is close to the dual-core CULV part from Intel. Not quite as fast in most of the benchmarks. In a couple of them, it's tied or maybe just slightly above, but there are a couple of instances where the performance of the Celeron CULV part is a little bit above what the Bobcat cores are able to do. But what's interesting is what the graphics side does. Mm-hmm. And in that area, the 80 stream processors is essentially what this part has. So you can compare that to, 4500, maybe 4400 series graphics cards, something previous generation, but still relatively good. It is outperforming the NVIDIA Ion chipset pretty much across the board. Probably the one test that kind of stood out, Left 4 Dead 2 performances were right about on par. 3D Mark Vantage, the score on the AMD APU was significantly higher than the GPU score. So we've kind of got these two different sides of things. It's almost the performance of CULV and almost the performance, or a little bit better the performance than the NVIDIA Ion chipset. But what really makes all this really kind of cool is because, those performance levels don't really excite us, right? We've got cards that do much, much better than all that. But mobile, talking about power consumption, if we looked at the idle power consumption of that Intel CULV plus Ion platform, it was about 21 watts. The AMD APU platform was 9 watts. So less than half of that, which you think for a netbook, notebook, the majority of the time, your system mm-hmm. is going to be in an idle state or very close to an idle state. So that's going to mean a lot for battery life. And AMD basically came out and said, look, the first machines that we're going to come out with, we posted pictures of an MSI notebook. I think it was a 13-inch screen that's going to have this processor in it. And they said, look, we're seeing real-world battery times of like 10 hours.
Right? That's impressive. And
12 hours if we stretch it type of thing with a standard 6-cell battery. Now, obviously, right. These are numbers AMD's telling us, so we kind of take them for what you will.
These aren't like the early netbook numbers where it's like, we anticipate 4.5 hours of battery life. And then they're like, right. If you turn off Wi-Fi and you turn the screen all the way down and you don't open any applications and you just read a text file, they're not, the AMD's not restrictions on it, are they?
No. None of those. So, I mean, it's under like a full load, it's still using less power as well. 19 watts versus 29 watts, even when doing, the like Left 4 Dead 2, right? That's actually the battery test or the power test we use for load. So you're using a third less energy while you're gaming as well. So we assume that if the GPU and CPU are working for whatever application you're doing, whether or not it's a game or something else, that's going to be the case. So it was... pretty impressive for that, because you're basically looking at power consumption at or better than current generation Intel Atom processors, but performance well above what they provide. And I think it's going to be the first real competition for the Intel Atom marketplace, right? The Intel Atom, we really haven't seen performance change much in that area, because Intel didn't need to do anything, right? I mean, they were just kind of like, we can offer these parts. We don't really like these parts a whole lot. We're trying to get into cell phones and stuff, but netbooks, they don't make us a lot of money. But we're going to offer these because people are asking for them. Well, now they're going to have competition for that $300, $400, $500 notebook. And we'll be, Intel's a big company. I'm sure they're not just going to go, forget about it, and then still try to sell that same part. I'm sure they'll have updates and maybe super ultra low voltage versions of Sandy Bridge architectures and stuff that'll come out down the road that will make this interesting. But I think this makes it interesting now. When this comes out later in the winter, these platforms could be pretty compelling.
Cool. So we have to take a quick ad break. When we come back, Viking Satadim Online's micro, so I used to say Online's micro console. It's a tough one to say. Yes. And Dell's doing a tablet netbook thing.
Tablet netbook thing. But first, this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by the AARP Auto Insurance Program from the Hartford. For our audience members, over the age of 50, the AARP Auto Insurance Program from the Hartford can save you as much as $384 on your car insurance. With more than 3 million AARP members who are already enjoying the benefits of this program, benefits that include lifetime renewability, lifetime repair guarantee, and a 6-point claim guarantee, current customers describe the claims experience as fast, easy, and it's outstanding. Check them out today and get an 8-minute quote. Go to aarp.thehartford.com/podcast. That's aarp.thehartford.com/podcast. And thank them for their support of Twitch. Now, what else we got on the docket here?
Well, I was going to say we've been kind of laughing, like following the MacBook Air, and then we see an obscure Taiwanese company comes out with an upgrade for it, and then Toshiba turns out to be the manufacturer of that DIM, yeah, or that SO drive, that weird sort of PCI Express drive package that was inside the MacBook Air. Now you've got the SATA DIM from Viking. This is bizarre, dude.
It really came out of left field for us. Our storage guy, Alan Alventano, got sent one of these, and it's a SATA DIM, and it's pretty much exactly what it sounds like, only not as cool as you might think it is just by thinking what it is. So it's basically a solid state drive in the form factor of a DDR memory stick.
Right.
Okay. And you plug this into a DIM slot on a motherboard, and it draws power from the motherboard to power the SSD through that, but it doesn't use the DIM slot to transfer data. Instead, it has a SATA port on the PCB of that DIM module, so to speak, right? That you then run a standard SATA cable to whatever controller, you know, motherboard controller or external RAID card, those types of things that you want. So it's actually identical in performance to other SandForce SSDs we have seen before, but it's very interesting type take on the form factor for this.
So is this going to be showing up on Blade servers, or is it an existing? I mean, are they basically just making gigantic memory modules here? Because that's the part that kind of confused the heck out of me reading the article and looking at Viking slides. Yeah. Is like, what's actually out there that can use like 64 gigabytes on a DIMM?
Well, it doesn't show up like the memory controller, whether that be on a Northbridge or on a processor, doesn't see it.
Okay.
Right? It doesn't use it as memory. It basically, you know, you have a SATA cable that goes to the motherboard, and it just shows up like an SSD. It's just a different form factor. It's not a 2.5-inch drive. It's not a 3.5-inch drive.
It's just basically using the DIM slot for power.
It's using the DIM slot for power, and it's using, you know, their market here is not really consumers, end users. Their market here is really, really high density servers where you're trying to get as much compute power into as little space as possible. Right. And, you know, if you've looked at high-end server motherboards, they might have 16, you know, 24, 32 DIM slots because some applications require huge amounts of frame buffer. Well, if you've got 12 or 10 or 5 free DIM slots, now that they're saying is you can fill those up with SSDs up to, you know, 240 gigabytes.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's really meant for server class. Maybe if you've got, like, mini ITX, ultra-small form factor, you know, home servers you want to build and that kind of stuff. You know, I mean, you can put one of these in here. They're going to be pretty expensive, I would guess. But you're right. Go ahead.
No, I was sitting there. It's like when I realized the light bulb went on above my head, I'm like, okay, I can use a DIM to power it. It's a SATA drive. And then I'm like, oh, okay, I can finally turn an eBox into a usable server. And then I'm like, I can already turn an eBox into a usable server. I just can't, you know, put the SATA drive or the hard drive inside the case. And then my second thought was like, wait a minute, this is going to be prohibitively expensive.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So their example on the slides is if you have 32 SATA DIMMs in a platform with a 1U depth, they're talking about 128 of these devices at 400 gigs apiece for up to 51.2 terabytes of serial ATA storage. Now, obviously, you got to have something to run all those SATA cables too, so it's not, you know, just as easy as plopping these down. But it's interesting because, like you said, with the Apple thing, it just shows you, you know, when you're talking about standard hard drives, they were in that shape because there were platters and there were heads and there were very specific things that needed to be in that form factor. We don't need to be in that form factor anymore. Hence why, you know, Apple doing that thing with their MacBook Air makes sense. Why soldering SSD memory onto motherboards for really small notebooks also made sense at one point. And why things like this can make sense. And, you know, maybe we'll have more interesting designs for consumers, not just the server markets in the not too distant future.
Speaking of new designs for the consumer market, on live, your favorite peculiar off-site rendering 3D gaming platform has a micro console. What is the point of it? It's a $100 box that allows you to basically not use your computer?
So the idea here is that they're supposed to sell the micro console to users that don't have a computer or don't have a computer at their living room but want to use the OnLive service. So this basically is a $99 USB HDMI hub with a networking port that connects to your network, connects your home network, and thus connects to the internet and can communicate with the OnLive service. It has USB ports and also supports wireless OnLive branded and designed made controllers. Has HDMI out. It has digital optical audio out, Ethernet. Analog audio and a special AV cable as well that I guess breaks out into like a component or composite or something like that. But the idea here is they're going to sell a $100 device to get on live in places where you might not want to put a computer or, you know, getting these into, you know, other types of users and that type of thing. I mean, it's an interesting... This is what they showed when they first announced on live was, hey, are you going to be able to play on your laptop, on your computer, on your Mac? But we're also going to be able to sell you this little device that can sit on your home theater center or on your home theater area. You don't have to have a computer attached to it. You don't have to worry about booting up Windows and installing software and, you know, all that other kind of stuff with this. You just access it like a gaming console, only they call it a micro console because you don't have to have any computing power on it because it's all computed on the cloud, right? That's kind of the supposed magic of online, right? You don't need any local computing power except to decode your video stream and send out whatever control information you're going to send out. So it's kind of interesting.
I almost feel like this is their major market. OnLive's major market isn't going to be the home. It's going to be hotels. Because I don't know if you've traveled and you see the places where they've got like the little Nintendo NES system or, you know, or the virtual NES system. You grab the controller off the TV, you drag it back to the bed, you play some horrible game from, you know, 1992. But this actually, this could be an interesting. The pricing on this is cheap enough that you could retrofit a hotel with one of these. You could rent the controllers out, charge something like that. I mean, I'll be really curious to see what online major market is. Do they have any, are they talking at all about how many users they have or whether the business is ramping up the way they expected?
So that's an interesting question. They're not really saying how many users they have. I'm trying to think. There was a stat in the story at Engadget where they said the only number they would talk about is that they have played, they have had 2 million sessions of OnLive played on Mac and PC so far. 2 million sessions being, I'm guessing, starting up the OnLive service and either playing a game or doing something like that. And I don't know, you know, if that counts the beta or if it doesn't count the beta and how impressive a number that actually is. It seems maybe a little low to me. You know, it's one data point. We don't know how many of these people tried it and then canceled it or tried it and never started it again type of thing.
Considering there's probably like 50 million people playing, you know, Steam right now.
Right. I bet if you go to Steam powered, it'll say that there are 2.4 million people, 2.5 million people playing something on Steam right that moment. So 2 million sessions, not a huge number. I mean, it's not bad, but, you know, they're increasing their allotment of games. I think they're up to about 40 now. They say by the end of next year, they'll have over 100 titles. They're trying to work on Netflix-like flat rate pricing plans for back catalogs and indie games and that kind of stuff. I mean, there's a lot of interesting things to do on this, right? I still have the same reservations about the technology. That hasn't changed because of this. It just puts it in a different spot in the house. You know, again, it's one of those things. It's like, I'll probably buy one just so I can try it out and talk about it here and have an intelligent discussion. But I don't think I'm going to fall in love with it. So
Well, it's an option. And by the way, steampower.com says that there's 1,622,737 gamers on Steam right now. Just saying. One more news story before we get into the questions. The Tel Inspiron Duo is now on pre-order. If you haven't seen this, it's a 10.1-inch notebook with a reversible screen that turns it into a 10.1-inch tablet. It's kind of a cousin to the IdeaPad from Lenovo. They're really the only two convertible netbooks out there that we've seen so far. $549 for, did we mention Atom processors not getting more powerful? Intel's Atom N550, 2 gigabytes of RAM, a Broadcom Crystal HD accelerator, which I like because it means getting 1080p video out of this thing is actually a possibility. 250 gigabytes of storage and Windows 7 Home Premium. So to me, at least 2 gigabytes of RAM is a step up from the netbooks I have, but it's a very, if you haven't seen it, you should definitely check it out. It is a PCMag.com did a pretty good write-up on it. They haven't done a full review yet, but they got a little bit of hands-on time. I think Engadget might have been on it. But yeah, a lot of people were like, it's really funny because I can, the screen literally rotates inside. There's kind of like a bezel, and then the screen rotates one way or the other. And I have this vision of my toddler flipping that thing around just to see how like fast it'll go.
As fast as you could go, yeah.
But at least it's, you know, it's a decent like 5400 RPM hard drive, 250 gigabytes is pretty dense, 320 gigabytes, 7200 RPM option on that one. And a 7-in-1 card reader, which is actually pretty cool. No, excuse me, the dock has a 7-in-1 card reader, Ethernet and USB. But that one, I just thought it was kind of fascinating to see. You know, part of me is like, this is a really interesting design. And part of me is like, is this the last gasp of the netbook? But the tablet design kind of really interesting. If you take a look at it, the sort of the oversimplified operating system they have for that, which could be a really nice little media player to tuck in a corner of your house.
Yeah. I tell you what, it's just like, I feel like I want one or the other. I can't imagine a time when I would actually want it, but I've been playing with the Galaxy tablet off and on for the last few days. And kind of really come to like the form factor of that. Even Ken, again, our editor, who's, you know, not an Apple fanboy or anything like that, but he uses a lot of Apple products. He says, I can kind of definitely see the use of a 7-inch tablet versus a 10-inch tablet like the iPad. So I'm not sure, you know, how useful a tablet of that size is going to be, because it's going to be thicker, it's going to be heavier, it's going to be lower battery life, all that kind of stuff. I don't know if it's going to come off of being like just a kind of a gimmick type of thing.
Well, you know, I could also point out that part of the reason you want one or the other is because you have one of everything.
That's true.
You don't have one.
I had to go to the Apple store today looking for a headset, and those MacBook Airs were still staring at me. And they actually have the ones with 4 gigs of memory in stock. And I was like, and there's no sales tax in Portland. So I was like, nah.
I would buy. I've been using my wife's a bunch, and it is a very nicely engineered piece of hardware, and it weighs nothing in my backpack.
The only problem is the only one they have in like there for you to pick up. That's my issue. It's like, I don't want to order online. It's the 2.1 gigahertz, 256 gig, 13-inch, like the top one, $17.99 is its price. And I'm kind of like, Anyway, let's see. Before we get into our emails, we want to thank our second sponsor of today's podcast. That would be Carbonite Pro. Carbonite Pro backs up all of the PCs in your business automatically whenever they're connected to the internet. It's safe. Your files are encrypted before they leave your computer for maximum security. It's easy to use whether you're a computer novice or a full-fledged techie. It's automatic. Carbonite backs up your files automatically whenever you are online. It's affordable. Prices starting at just $10 a month, and you only pay for the amount of backup you actually need. And it's one account with one monthly bill, which should simplify things for just about everybody. Carbonite Pro gives you a centralized dashboard to give you or your administrator or whoever wants to be in charge of this a backup status summary of all the computers in your business. If there's ever a data loss problem, each employee can access their own backup files themselves. You can be notified, and your office can be up and running again with no headache or time lost. And because your files are backed up offsite, each person can access their own files from any computer or even their iPhone or BlackBerry with Carbonite's free applications. All of this means you can focus on growing your business and leave the backup to Carbonite Pro. Now they're going to lets you try this service for 30 days free. All you have to do is go to carbonitepro.com. No offer code or anything like that. All you have to do is visit carbonitepro.com, and we thank them for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware.
Thank you very much. All right, let's fire up some email questions. First one we're going to do, and this one's kind of, I can't decide if this excites me or terrifies me. We're going to talk about SSDs in RAID. Andrew writes in, hey, I love your show. I was wondering about solid-state drives. Do you think it would be better if I got two SSDs and put them into RAID 0 or just get one big one? I look at the read-write speeds on Newegg, and it seems with more capacity, they offer greater speeds. I know these are just projected specs, but I was wondering why they would be faster. Also, I hear they degrade over time with or without trim support. Is this true? Oh, Andrew, you wild creature, you.
There's a lot of questions in there, isn't there?
Well, okay. I am not a fan of RAID 0. I despise RAID 0.
I know a lot of people that feel that way.
I find RAID 0 is a wonderful opportunity for modest performance increases with even a more awesome opportunity to have a fail. Basically, you know, one of the drives fails, you pretty much lost all of your data. You're not getting it back. So if you do decide to create a RAID 0, get your striping on, do me a favor and make sure you back up your critical data very regularly, like every day, like get your Carbonite account going and make sure that thing's keeping your updates in there. Because, look, I'm all for being a speed demon, but RAID 0 can punish you severely if things go wrong. More capacity, greater speeds, is that a function of the controller being able to write to more pieces of memory simultaneously, or are they just, as the newer drives come out, are they getting faster?
No, it's more of with some drives, depending on the controller and the architecture behind it, the larger capacity means that they can write to more channels of memory at one time or read from more channels of memory at one time, hence why you get some performance improvements. Usually you'll see like a 40 and an 80 be at one speed set, and you'll see like the 120, 160, and 250 be at another speed set, because that's kind of how, you know,
it's like internal striping.
Yeah. I mean, it does come down to that. Now, I completely agree with you on RAID 0. All that being said, I have a RAID 0 SSD array running on our video editing rig. But we do a lot of backups.
You're a freak for the speed.
Right. When you're doing video editing and that kind of stuff, I mean, it's just awesome to have. Also, I should say, there are no RAID controllers, high-end external drives or ones on motherboards that will support trim over a RAID array. So trim That's goes to the problem. Operating system, and because it sees an array of drives, it just can't pass on those things to each individual drive. That's coming in the future, but that is not an option right now.
So what if you, in terms of, so trim is an idea that it's going to recover lost data, is that basically in the way data is handled, data is written and handled in the drive. Trim is designed to keep the drive from basically becoming filled up and useless. What if I just like create my perfect installation, back it up, and then back it up off of the RAID, and then, or image it onto a second hard drive, and then when things start to slow down in terms of performance, I could blow out the installation that's on the RAID, my SSD RAID, and sort of like every 6 months we need to reinstall the operating system? Or are you seeing performance degradation? I mean, you're the man running the RAID 0. Are you seeing performance degradation over time?
No, I don't think so. It really depends on what drives you use. Most of the newer drives are doing better, what we call garbage collection, self-cleaning, those types of things. If you go to – Alan has a really good kind of reference. If you go to pcper.com/SSD, we have our Rolodex or – Coda ring of SSDs, and you'll see some in there that if they're listed as having quote garbage collection, it means they're trying to perform the function of trim internally on themselves. So those are the types of drives you would, if you're going to do RAID 0, maybe you pick one of those drives because you don't have to worry about trim support coming from the operating system. But look at the price difference. If it's like two 120s of the Intel are going to be X number of dollars less than a single 160 or two 160s. You know, I mean, go into the price thing. It's always better to have one drive. I agree. But like we had two 256s to make one 512 array because we couldn't buy anything bigger than that at the time. So there is that as well.
Okay. I personally, I'd rather you go with a single drive. A RAID, if you want to get it on, is an option. But it's in definitely look for the garbage collection on the RAID situation. That's an interesting thought. Andy writes in the past few weeks on Twitch, there have been some questions about quiet computing for people who are, quite understandably, not willing to give up on gaming performance. He says there are a few good passively cooled graphics cards which allow for decent gaming. For example, the Silent Cell series from Gigabyte, which currently has a 5770 as the highest end offering. One of these cards or two in Crossfire gives pretty decent gaming performance with no noise at all, and is worth considering for anyone who's building a PC where noise is an important factor. I've built machines with this kind of card before, and they work really well. Keep up the great work, Andy. Well, thanks, Andy. I'm actually kind of surprised the 5770 is running with a silent.
Yeah, I think last week I might have said that the fastest card I saw that was running passively was a 5750. So, I mean, that's why I put this in here, is because he basically corrected us and said there's a Silent Cell series from Gigabyte, a 5770, which is good. And as he says, you can do two in Crossfire and still run them passively. You need to make sure your case has good airflow if you're running passive graphics cards. You know, as quiet as you want it, but it needs to be good airflow. You can't just stuff it all into a box and close all the holes because there's no fans on it. Don't do that.
You also probably want to make sure you have enough room inside in between your GPU slots, because this is a huge, it's basically a giant passive heatsink on this with vent tubes that are going outside. Yeah, well, giant by my standards. It might not be giant by your standards, but you know, it looks like it's got an extra sort of inch or so sticking out above the card. I'll be curious actually to measure the dimensions on that. But yeah, actually, I'm in the process of sort of quieting down the PC that I've been using at home, and I'm also in the market to do a GPU upgrade, so that would actually be kind of tempting to have a silent GPU. Chris, do you want to read Chris's email about silent
PCs? Chris has another kind of note here about silent PC building. He says, in September, he built a new gaming rig, almost completely silent. During gaming, it's certainly unnoticeable with the speakers going. Stand up, take a step back, and the only reason you know it's on is from the LED glow. He used a Cooler Master HAFX case, Corsair H50 cooler on a Core i7-950. I know both of us really like those coolers. A Radeon or a Sapphire Radeon HD 5870 with their Vapor X cooler, which is uses vapor chamber cooling so that the fans can spin at lower speeds and still keep the GPU cool. And that's a 5870, so it's not going to be silent like the passive 5870 that Andy mentioned, but it's going to be pretty quiet. And then he has a PC power and cooling 750-watt silencer power supply, so I assume that means that it's nearly silent, if its name is Silencer. Kind of makes sense. And he's got a 240-gig SSD, so he's got a nice rig there. He's running on a 1920x1080 24-inch monitor, all the video settings set to max in games like Bad Company or Civ 5, and it is really almost completely silent. I've yet to see the processor getting over 50 degrees. It's the best damn rig he's ever built. I just kind of wanted to show this as like, hey, you know, you can build quiet things. You just got to be kind of picky about what parts you're going to get, right? You know, get the something like the Corsair H50. You know, keep in mind, some people don't realize, like, your power supply can make a lot of noise. We replace all the power supplies in our testing areas, in our testing lab, because we wanted to test use a sound meter for audio testing, and the loudest thing in the room was the power supply. You know, and there's a lot of those things you just don't think about. So it's always good to look at reviews and stuff that measure sound levels of things like power supplies that many people might not worry about.
It can also be a lot less expensive to build a quiet PC when you decide to build a new PC for scratch or do a major upgrade. Because if you build a PC and then you start going like, gosh, that GPU fan's really loud, and you replace the GPU fan and you go, gosh, my CPU fan's really loud, and you replace the CPU fan and you go, gosh, my power supply sounds really loud, and you replace your power supply, and then all of a sudden, you know, you're like, I can hear my hard drive, so you upgrade the hard drive, and you've replaced, you know, a couple $100 in hardware, if not a lot more than that. Seth has an interesting question that I couldn't resist. He says, I put a Blu-ray printer in my home theater PC, and I want to start backing up and transcoding my Blu-ray collection. Why not just rip them to ISO files? You probably would need a gigantic offline storage system for that, like a NAS box. But it's only like 30 to 50 gigabytes per movie. He says, I intend on turning them into MKV files, but I was wondering if you guys know of any really good software to use. I've ripped DVDs before, but never Blu-rays, and I've heard that some of the software out there will allow you to use your GPU to accelerate transcoding. Probably not any of the – here's the deal, dude, right? You know, you can like – I can use my GPU to accelerate my decoding, and it's like, well, you can use your GPU to accelerate encoding of legal files, but most of the software designed to allow you to accelerate the transcoding of files that you've ripped off of a DVD or Blu-ray after you've bypassed the copy protection, which is – closely guarded in the United States by the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. The companies that sort of hold the keys to the tools for those maybe tend not to be real, kind of like, hey, you know, go ahead and take our unbelievably cool technology and use it to pirate copies, you know, pirate, you know, content so we can be sued by Hollywood. Long story short is yes, there are certainly tools to accelerate encoding, but they're still mostly really tied to stuff that's available from the manufacturers. Feel free to email me with your 10,000 applications that are not closely aligned to the manufacturers.
I have one tool that I have tested. I haven't tested with Blu-rays, but we've done it with DVDs. Right. It's called Media Espresso. It's from CyberLink.
I haven't touched that in a long time. They're good. CyberLink's actually got some interesting stuff going on these days.
Yeah, so they say they can import formats of MKV, and then it lists a whole bunch of other ones. I just remember seeing the MKV there, but it does M2T, M2TS, MTS, so a lot of, let's say, file formats that might be associated with unruly activities. Right, and it does support ATI and NVIDIA GPU acceleration for this transcode process. I'm not 100% sure that it would work, but it's definitely worth downloading the free demo for this. I mean, it's only a $40 application anyway, so download the demo, see if it will. You know, the illegal part here is the questionably illegal part is getting the content to your hard drive.
Well, it's
and
here's
then
the thing:
if transcoding there's, it is different.
If there's copy protection on the Blu-ray, and almost invariably Blu-ray discs there is copy protection. If you're talking about like a major movie or a, you know, something that's been on television on any of the main channels, it's on there. So the primary transcoding goes on in there when you take like the H.264, you know, MPEG-4 AVC or the VC1 file off of the Blu-ray, and then you want to transcode it and probably significantly compress it. It's because you're literally talking about huge files. Like, it's easy to have a 30, 40 gigabyte file. 20 to 30 gigabytes is pretty typical. You know, Seth uses AnyDVD HD to rip, which is pretty awesome. It doesn't have any software to transcode. You know, ripping to ISO is an option for Blu-ray if you have a big drive or if you build a NAS drive, which is what several friends of mine have done. They've archived their Blu-rays to the NAS and they have the access to them over their home theater PCs, which is really convenient, and you get all of the quality of the original Blu-ray. And sometimes if you have an older Blu-ray drive in your PC, it boots up faster. Yeah. If you don't want to spend the money for AnyDVD HD, and personally, I think AnyDVD HD is absolutely worth the money. DVD Fab HD Decryptor has a free version you can download. I'm a big fan of Handbrake, which allows you to do a ton of different transcoding options. Maximum PC did a really good guide. They call it the last DVD and Blu-ray ripping guide you'll ever need. They used RipBot 264 for their Blu-ray stuff, and a lot of people love Xvid for PSP. I don't make a lot of MKV files and Matroska files, although I think in a lot of ways MKV files are the future because they allow you to assemble so many disparate elements. You know, I use it constantly. The little words show up on the screen that is
subtitles.
The
subtitles. How's that?
Thank you very much. Closed captioning. you know, you can drop in closed captioning. You can drop in multiple soundtracks or different languages. You can put a ton of fascinating stuff inside an MKV file. So I'm going to toss this out to the Twitch audience. Email us if you have a particularly favorite way to transcode, you know, H.264 or VC1 into your favorite MKV format. And then we got an email from Michael talking about iOS printing.
So it's not so much a question as it is a statement, but it's an interesting one, so we wanted to include it here. It says, you listen to our podcast every week. That's good news. While I commute to work through the traffic-packed area, Bay Area roadways. Anyway, to get to the point, he is an iOS developer, has an iOS developer account, and has given him access to the beta pre-releases of iOS. He's used 4.2 on his iPhone 4 and his iPad, and he has tested the printing features with much success. There are new printers from HP with ePrint, and so far I've tried many of them with my iPhone 4 running the pre-release 4.2 that have been able to print photos, web pages, and even PDF files with ease. The ePrint printers can print without the use of a computer. This requires your ePrint printer and iDevice to be on the same wireless network. So that's pretty cool. Even if you don't want to buy a new printer, you can still print with iOS 4.2, but there is a catch. The catch is that a future version of iTunes that's not out yet will support what Apple calls AirPrint, and you can share a printer from your computer, and it will print to your shared printer, but that it will require that your computer is on, connected to the same network, all that kind of stuff. He said he tested that on both his Wi-Fi printer and his USB printer shared, and it worked flawlessly. So I know we mentioned iPad printing last week, so I just kind of wanted to put that clarification in there since Michael sent that in. It was pretty good.
Yeah, and if you have a Canon, you can check out Canon's Easy Photo Print for iPhone. HP's got iPrint Photo. And if you don't mind spending money, there's still AirSharing HD, which I think still costs $10, which is kind of pricey. Ryan, you have a basketball game to attend, am I correct?
Yes, I'm going to go to the Portland Trail Blazers game tonight, which is in a half an hour. And then tomorrow we have the University of Kentucky playing Portland. So you can look for me on TV at both of those games. But don't hold it against me, whatever I'm going to be doing.
As long as you don't show up naked, painted blue, or whatever the color of the Kentucky team is. All right, folks, this is this is Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware. We're going to call it a week. Do us a favor. Email us. Ryan, what is the email address?
Twitch@twit.tv. Easy to get to.
PCPer.com is Mr. Shroud's website. You can find me now. Techzilla 2 times a week. We're doing 2 episodes of Techzilla a week. We've folded HD Nation inside of Techzilla. But we've got more computing coming at you. And we did our Boxy Box review this week. So if you've been waiting to see what the hardware version of the super popular open source application is like, do me a favor and go to Techzilla.com and check that one out. PCPer.com has an amazing collection of hardware resources, including everything we talked about today is going to be up there, except for the news stories about the Dell, because Ryan doesn't like the Dell convertible pack.
Hey, we won't hold that against me quite yet. I'm sure we'll have lots of that stuff from CES.
Oh, man. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Trout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.